Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. Another action-packed episode for your viewing and listening pleasure.
Well, you've been kicking up a lot of dust. You've been earning your rhino cred, taking pot shots at all of your top Republican candidates. Made everybody's life miserable.
I even wore a polo shirt with a blazer on TV the other day. That's like the rhino. I think that's like the rhino uniform.
You got on at least MSNBC as far as I know. I don't I it's hard to keep track of it all. But you had a big piece in the British newspaper, The Telegraph, questioning whether Jeb really wants it. Does he have the fire in the belly, or is he just going through the motions to defend the family name after he kind of had a very awkward series of interviews and appearances last week where it took him but four or five tries to get the Iraq answer correctly. You questioned if that meant he wasn't really doing what it takes to win because he doesn't really want it that badly. Am I summing you up correctly?
That's right, Bill. I essentially took a page out of the Bill Scheer playbook and sought to take history and inject some history into a timely political moment to do some context and analysis. And I basically compared it to 1979 when Ted Kennedy is planning on running, primarying Jimmy Carter, running for president. He does an interview with Roger Mudd, famously asks the question, "Why do you want to be president?" And Kennedy gives a very bumbling answer. People wonder, how could it be that Ted Kennedy, of all people, is not prepared to answer this very obvious and predictable question? And there's some smart commentators at the time who speculate that this was Kennedy sort of subconsciously self-sabotaging himself, that he deep down really didn't want to run, that he felt he was expected to run as the remaining male heir of the Kennedy family and legacy. And it struck me that maybe there's some of that psychologically at play with Jeb Bush. You know, this was also a predictable and obvious question. He really mishandled it, bobbled it really for days. And being sort of the heir to the Bush legacy, the Bush dynasty, one wonders, does he have the fire in the belly? Does he really want to run? Or is he also, maybe subconsciously, deep down, not even realizing it, self-sabotaging? So I don't know the answer to it, but I do think when you look at the fact that it was an obvious and predictable question, Bush's body language sort of betrays the fact that he doesn't seem to have that passion about this run. And I raise it as an interesting question, and I'll throw it to you, Bill. Is this a commentator commentating? Or is there any there?
Well, it's really worth raising the question. I didn't have the same interpretation of it. I think there is a connection between the Kennedy and the Jeb interviews in that it reveals a lack of preparation for an obvious question. That's something that really should have been thought through ahead of time. And in the case of Kennedy, I mean the reason why that question is kind of a hardball disguised as a softball is the vast majority of people that run for president don't have a discrete set of issues that are driving them to run. They're running out of personal ambition and wanting to have a lot of power and influence over a whole wide range of things. I mean, it doesn't mean that they are necessarily completely craven, but it's not like, I'm really upset about the tax code in our country and I'm going to run for that. And then once I solve that problem, I don't really care about being president anymore. I'll go off and do something else. I mean, very few people think that way.
But you have to,
So.
I think you're onto something there. And clearly, Ted Kennedy, even putting aside personal ambition, he couldn't say, "Well, I'm running because my two dead brothers can't run. I'm running to avenge their, to continue their legacy." I mean, maybe there's a way he could have nuanced it and said that, but you sort of have to have a fake reason, right? I mean,
Right.
a raison
And
d'être.
you have to think through your fake reason
Yeah.
ahead of time. And I think after the Roger Mudd interview, every candidate in their preparation sessions goes through what are you going to say when you're asked why are you running? So you haven't seen people really bobble that question in a long time. And in the Jeb situation, I think that he was very committed to the, it wasn't a mistake to go in. There were some mistakes along the way, but it was basically a good idea. And at the end of the day, it was Barack Obama had screwed all up by pulling folks out. And he really wanted to, I mean, there's a basic technique in media training called bridging, where you probably you see it all the time. You don't necessarily put a term on it, but that's when no matter what question you get asked, you answer the question you wanted to have asked. And in a lot of circumstances, you get away with that because the full clip with the question and the answer doesn't get repeated. Maybe your answer gets repeated, or your answer gets put into the print story afterwards. But the whole back and forth doesn't usually get in unless it is obviously embarrassing, and there's sort of an extended back and forth. You're getting kind of called on it, and you're being asked three or four or five times. Then that kind of thing comes up. So I think he was kind of making that play, whether totally consciously or unconsciously, and he got burned. So I think that's potentially different than a fire in the belly problem. He may have that too. But I said there's more than one way you can, more than one underlying reason why you botch a question like that.
I agree with you in terms of the first, remember he bungled this for days on end, but the first question that Megyn Kelly asked him, maybe he like didn't hear it or like didn't catch the caveat knowing what we know now. Or maybe he is doing what essentially we teach political candidates to do, which is answer the question that you want to answer. Ignore the question. But you're right, though, there is this thing called bridging. And ideally, what you do is find a way to answer the question you want to answer by not, but not necessarily ignore the question. So you can say things like, so for example, like they might say, one transition is like, the moms and dads that I talk to in my district tell me the most important thing to them is blank. So you're parrying the question, you're changing the subject, but you're not doing it out of nowhere. It's not apropos of nothing. You're sort of transitioning and you're still
And in the
answering.
Jeb case, in the Jeb case, he could have done that. He could have said, "Well, look, obviously, if the intelligence said something totally different, we probably wouldn't be having that discussion in 2003. But it's a good thing Saddam is gone. It's a bad thing mistakes were made along the way. And I think we have to learn all the lessons going forward."
That's a
You
good
know?
point. No, I think you're right. I think he could have said, that's a hypothetical, but I will say this, Megan, I think we have to learn the lessons of the past, which includes the fact that, what some people present to a president as a slam dunk intelligence, we need to view skeptically. But let me just say this. I think the real question is, what would we have done knowing what we knew at the time? And I can tell you, there's one person running for president right now, Hillary Clinton, who made the decision to vote to intervene. So I think he could have answered the question and gotten out of it. And interestingly, I argue that Bush's inability to effectively answer that question actually sort of quickened the movement of all the other Republicans to disavow the Iraq War. And so now it's essentially the consensus of almost all the candidates is that knowing what we know now, they would not have gone into Iraq. I think that Jeb Bush actually helped create that situation, which, if you think about it, Bill, is an amazing development. It wasn't that long ago where I think it would have been unanimously on the other side, where everybody would have said, yes, Saddam was a bad guy. We had to get rid of him no matter what. It was the right thing to do, whether or not there were WMDs.
But I also think that that's been somewhat cosmetic. It's not like the Republican Party's foreign policy philosophy has been completely overhauled because of it. It's like we're not all Rand Paul now. People are still talking in their stump speeches in terms of ISIS. We need more boots on the ground. We gotta take them out. Enough of this. We gotta call radical Islam by its name and just and drop bombs on them, and that's it. There's not a lot of nuanced, sophisticated approach to their foreign policy rhetoric in terms of the problem at hand. It still sounds a whole lot like what it sounded like in 2003.
Oh yeah, no,
So I.
I agree. I think it would be a mistake to take this development and extrapolate that now Republicans are a bunch of doves and that they, that they're, isolationist or something. That's certainly not the case. But I do hope that there are lessons learned, and we've talked about this, ad nauseum. But one of them I think would be to be skeptical of, intel reports. The CIA gets things wrong a lot. I think also to be skeptical about our ability to nation build and to export democracy. And then I think there, obviously, there's room to share the blame, although I think that the less I think one of the big lessons to learn is not to attempt nation building. There were a lot of mistakes that we made that really made the problem worse, right? So the de-Ba'athification was obviously a horrible idea. Dismissing the Iraqi army was obviously a horrible idea. Dexter Filkins has a great piece in the New Yorker about this. I think President Obama's decision to not leave residual forces behind was a disastrous idea. There's a lot of lessons to learn, and I think Republicans need to spread that blame around. It's certainly fair to concede that, knowing what we know now, going into Iraq was a huge mistake. I think it's also fair to say, having made that mistake, we could have had a much better outcome had we done counterinsurgency sooner, had there been more troops sooner, the sort of the Petraeus model, had they gotten rid of Rumsfeld sooner. And then certainly if President Obama had kept more, after the surge finally did work, more residual forces behind, we could have a much more stable, better Iraq today. Now, the problem is, it would still be almost essentially a puppet state of Iran. So that's why it's a little bit crazy to topple the Saddam regime, despite, even if you put aside all the lost lives and money and everything else, even if Iraq were a more stable place today, if ISIS hadn't arisen there, you would still basically have a country that is not providing the check, the balance that it once did to the Iranian regime.
Well, I think that's sort of the tough part of your critique there. You're saying we shouldn't be nation building, but we should be staying in some capacity. I think there's a way to square the two points. You're not necessarily saying you're spending money into state infrastructure or whatnot, but but there's still sort of in for a penny, in for a pound once you go in on that scale. I just think that. Right now, I think Republicans, by and large, want to just blame Obama for Iraq because of that pullout, and they don't want to get into all the other things that you're bringing up, like de-Ba'athification and such. They don't want to have a full range of lessons learned in
Right.
this. They still want to get the make the political point, and I think they need to internalize that there is some pretty deep skepticism of Republican ability to handle foreign policy in a complicated world, and maybe the best thing to do is not to just go for the cheap political hit, the partisan hit. Maybe it's time to, give a longer speech. Maybe it's not going to win you a ton of votes in a 24-hour news cycle, but you got to start kind of giving forth a sense that you have a complex understanding of a complicated
Yeah.
situation,
Well, I think it's
and not
I think
just
you're right,
resting on.
and I think it's dangerous to not think through these issues. And frankly, I think that that's part of maybe what led Jeb to make his week-long series of, I think it took him five tries to get to the right answer on that one. I do wonder. I mean, political correctness isn't the right word, but basically there is a dogma that political parties and ideologies adhere to. And when there's a dogma, it means you don't have to think through things. So the dogma, it was not kosher. For years, it was not kosher to concede that, knowing what we know now, it was a mistake to go into Iraq. So you didn't have to really think through that, because the safe sort of go-to answer was Saddam was a horrible guy. The world is much better off now that he's gone. So then that means you don't have to think it through. You don't have to challenge that notion and really question yourself as to whether or not that's true, whether or not that's accurate, whether or not that holds water. And I suspect that you could almost call it like a political correctness, a dogma that said that was the answer, it's a dangerous thing to have. Like, I feel like you need to constantly be challenging your premises of things and your assumptions about things. And I think that because I started off my career, for whatever reason, doing a lot of MSNBC, that's a habit that I've developed more maybe than some other conservatives, because I was more accustomed to having things challenged and having to defend things, in which some cases were indefensible. And now you're on the campaign trail, you're running for president, and public opinion starts to change, but you haven't done the investment of thinking through ideas. I just wonder how much of that's behind this kind of debacle that we saw play out last week.
Now, Jeb is not the only person who's had a problem answering questions in the past few days. Marco Rubio got into a protracted back and forth over Iraq with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. And as you flagged the other day, Scott Walker got hit on Brett Breyer's Fox News special report on flip-flopping and immigration. And as you point out, Scott Walker had to redefine what a flip-flop is. That's when you vote one way and say something else, not when you change your position completely for political reasons, which is how most people interpret flip-flop. Because he's acknowledged that he's changed his mind on immigration to no longer support quote-unquote amnesty, but he doesn't want to say that it's a flip-flop change of mind. And what's striking to me about all these circumstances is that they all happened on Fox News.
Yeah.
And this is when, you're not seeing a lot of Republican candidates go outside of the conservative media bubble at this stage, presumably because you want to get friendly questioning and you want to speak to the people who are going to vote in the Republican primary. You have the RNC saying earlier, we're going to seize control of the debates. We're not going to let the liberal media run these debates. We're not going to let George Stephanopoulos ask gotcha questions about contraception. We're going to have, they'll be traditional media, but they'll be partnered with conservative media personalities like Hugh Hewitt. And that will lead to a more reasonable discussion. But as we've seen in the past few days, you can get tripped up with a conservative media questioner. They can still throw hardballs at you. They can throw softballs at you that you still right. don't handle well.
Well, Bill, I feel deja. It feels like deja vu. I feel like we just had this talk last week, and I think it's because we just had this talk last week. But it's still valid, and I think you're right. I mean, the interesting thing is, I've seen this happen where I work here at the Daily Caller, where candidates think wrongly that our job is to promote them, and they're stunned, Republicans, candidates that is, and Republican politicians are stunned when we, write something critical of them, because we're journalists and that's what we're supposed to do, when we'll call them like we see them. And I do, there's probably a danger of lulling yourself into a false sense of security, thinking you're playing a home game. And guess what? Megyn Kelly is a good interviewer. Chris Wallace is a great and serious journalist, and Brett Baer is too. I mean, the three people, and even Sean Hannity, I think Sean Hannity on this radio show was trying to actually help Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush actually even managed to botch that. So, point well taken. You go on TV just because, I mean, the benefit to having a center-right journalist interview you is they do not inherently hold your worldview hostile. We're not hostile to your worldview. We're not going to maybe try to ask the kind of gotcha questions that someone on the left might, but you're still going to be challenged. And it's an obvious mistake to go in there thinking that you're going to get softball questions. I mean, again, these are pros, and they're going to ask tough questions, and they want to break news, and they want people to be talking about their show. And here we are talking about, you know, Chris Wallace's interview. I will say this, and I've said this before and I've written about this, but I think the Rubio thing deserves an asterisk. You know, Chris Wallace was pressing Rubio over whether or not it was a, quote, mistake to go into Iraq. And the reason it became a moment, the reason that it became a scene, is that Rubio kept pushing back and they were having this fight, this disagreement. But I felt like Rubio was making a semantic point, which is to say, if President Bush believed that Iraq had WMDs at the time, was it a mistake based on what he believed to go in? I mean, I think that's a sort of debatable semantics question. And it seemed like they got hung up.
Tried to make a lot of semantic arguments about Iraq in 2004. It didn't get him very far.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I think Rubio would have been better off not to try to, like, split hairs and parse words there. He made a mistake by trying to quibble, I think, over that word usage.
So it was beginning on the debates for a little bit. I actually wrote a piece for Real Clear Politics the other day. Because there's this discussion, how are they going to whittle the field down? They run the risk of having as many as 18 or 19 candidates, depending on how many people actually follow through and announce between now and August, when the first debates are coming. They're only three months away, not too far away. I offer one of my usual helpful suggestions, Matt. You know, I always try to help. I can see that this is one. You know, usually I try to offer things where I think they actually might plausibly take. This one they're probably not going to take. But, I mean, they're already discussing various criteria. So it's not just polling. And there's a suggestion sort of in the reporting that if they just use polls, that might knock out Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson or Bobby Jindal. And that's going to severely limit the diversity. I mean, you might still have Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, but the chance to have a much more diverse stage is crimped if you'd use just a polling measure. So there's talk about, well, what about campaign activity or staff size or small dollar fundraising or even political experience? All those sorts of things are being... You could create a formula so people think that it's that's more holistic and more fair. And my argument is, and this is a serious argument, you know, you get a complicated formula, people are going to think you're trying to rig the game. It's going to look jiggered. It's going to look like a liberal stereotype. You got this complicated bureaucratic Rube Goldberg formula. You're wearing conservatives. You have clear lines. You're in and you're out. Winners or losers. I would argue, and you know, they've already brought fundraising into the discussion, apparently. But why not just make it about the money? You know, if you're a Republican, you're a conservative, you support Citizens United, you believe spending money is your First Amendment right. It's not something to be apologetic about. And look, all candidates, Democrat, Republican, when they're running, they brag about their numbers. That's the proof that you're winning early. That's the pre-primary. That's proof you got a broad base of support. People want to give you money. So why not just say, look, you raise the most money, the top 12 money raisers, you're in. And if you think that's unfair and you got cut out and you don't like it, then you try to raise money off of that. Say, they're trying to screw me. The Republican establishment is trying to shut us down. Give me money and get us back in the debates. And if you're worried about Hillary Clinton raising $2 billion, you better want somebody who can raise that money and has a real fundraising network, so they go toe-to-toe with her. So I think it's worth considering. I suspect they'll worry about the so-called optics with such a thing, that they look like they're craving. But I think if you believe money is speech, you should follow your own logic and put it on the table.
Well, I think you make a good argument. This is a column you wrote for Real Clear Politics, I think, right?
Right,
So
right.
go read that. You make a pretty compelling case because there are people who might be polling better, but they're not going to be serious candidates. And so I think you probably could make a pretty good argument that a better predictor ultimately of viability is not someone's poll numbers at this point, but their money raise, because that might imply that not only will they have the money to compete, but that they are taking it seriously, that they're going to be able to build the organization that's required to win in a place like, say, Iowa. So you make an interesting point. I do think the optics are unseemly. That making money the defining criteria for whether or not you get into a debate, I don't think that could work just for PR reasons, regardless of the validity of your argument. I do think it's worth saying, though, that it's a big deal who gets into these debates. So if there are like 20 people in debates, you can't have a legitimate or intellectual debate or discussion. It just doesn't happen. You get questions like, or raise your hand if you believe in evolution or don't believe in evolution. On the other hand, I would argue that the power to exclude somebody from a debate is the power to destroy, especially early on. If you get into a debate, you have a chance to prove yourself. That could in turn lead to fundraising. You could parlay that into, into raising money and to better poll numbers. So it's almost a catch-22, right? So you don't have enough money or poll numbers to get into the debate, but you can't raise your money or poll numbers because you didn't get into the debate. So I think Republicans have a real conundrum on their hands. The other problem would be, I mean, how do you exclude somebody? Let's say they decide to go with poll numbers. And let's say Ben Carson, who's never been elected to anything, is polling well. And John Kasich, in Ohio, the governor of Ohio, who was just, reelected with like 60 some percent of the vote, doesn't get in. Or on the other hand, let's say that somehow you go with the money and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina don't get in. Now you're depriving Republicans of the optics of having a diverse looking stage where you have an African American and a female candidate included in the mix of, Hispanics and an Indian American, Bobby Jindal. I think Republicans would obviously like to highlight the diversity on the stage as so they've got a real problem. Bobby Jindal's team has apparently suggested doing multiple debates where you sort of randomly pick these five candidates are going to go like, from 7 till 8, and then from 8 till 9, we're going to bring in five different candidates. Somebody over at Hot Air, I don't know if it was Ala or someone else over at Hot Air, suggested a series of one-on-one sort of Lincoln Douglas style debates. So having multiple debates, and maybe it becomes like a an NCAA tournament type thing where the winner goes on. This could be a real American Idol thing. Text
Well, I think there's logic to breaking up into smaller chunks. I think I suggested that last week. Once you get into, debate, you make it like a playoff situation. Look, someone who's a sharp debater, like Ted Cruz, you don't want that guy to win on debate points, even if, he's got no chance of winning the nomination or the general. That would make the whole party look bad. So I think that takes probably too much control out of the situation.
Well,
Well, here's
Bill,
one last donor argument. This is actually.
eventually it's going to be like, it's going to be, it's going to be the Hunger Games. I mean, eventually they're going to like kill the loser of these debates. I mean, eventually we're going to get to that. It's going to be a national entertainment spectacle, and
Well, we're basically already there.
the running man
But here's one
meets.
other donor argument I would make. That actually, I didn't make this in my piece. This is actually a serious recommendation. If you made it about the number of donors and not the number of dollars, then it's a race to see who has built up the biggest network of supporters.
Well, there is an argument, you get what you measure. And so, whatever it is that they want to, you need to incentivize doing whatever it is that that you want more of. So, I mean, that would make a certain amount of sense. But look, I just think early on, I think I would vote on breaking it up into chunks, do it randomly. let everyone who is minimally exceptional in five or six candidates in each chunk, and you would end up having maybe three or four debates, because I think there's going to be 20 some candidates, right?
I mean, Bolton's out. I mean, I think you have to have every last person who's sort of musing about it coming in if you're going to get up to 19 or 20. It's probably going to be a little bit short of that, I suspect.
So maybe you
but
could just have
it
two.
will probably be. Yeah, I mean, I think you could probably break it up into two rounds, and where you'd be, I think, under 10 candidates each, at least for the first one or two debates. I mean, and then you can do some more whittling later. It's not like everyone is clamoring to see an 18-person scrum, because you're going to get three questions.
Right.
And people will give soundbite answers, and there'll be very little in the way of exchanges, and you wouldn't get very far. So they have to think a little bit about how this is going to come across on TV. You need to have a good discussion for it to be remotely engaging, and just that many people just makes it completely it makes it dull.
I just occurred to me, Bill, I forgot something in our previous conversation about the Fox News thing, and that's Brett Baer on Special Report last night, Tuesday night, had Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, on, and he asked him about his flip-flops on immigration reform, and Scott Walker had this brilliant, actually, answer. He basically redefined what constitutes a flip-flop, and the new definition is, unless you voted on something, then you can change your mind. You could have been an elected official who made a very public statement, but that doesn't count as a flip-flop unless you voted on it. And so Scott Walker essentially is arguing that he is immune to the charge of flip-flopping, which I thought was kind of brilliant Clinton-esque move.
I mean, is that bright, or is that another example of Scott Walker not ready for prime time? I mean, how is that? You could take that answer in a debate and shove it back down his throat pretty quickly.
No, I think it's a brilliant. I think it was a very devious move that implies he's much craftier than I'd given him credit for.
Now we have another race that happened last night. It hasn't gotten a lot of media attention until now, at least outside of the state of Kentucky. But the Kentucky Republican gubernatorial primary was quite a battle. It was a three-way dead heat for a long time, and now it looks like Matt Bevin, who got trounced by Mitch McConnell in the Senate primary last year, is on the top of the heap by 83 votes. Although I think the military ballots and absentees haven't been counted yet. And James Comer, who is the current Secretary of Agriculture there, he's going to at least call for a recanvassing, which could then lead to a full-blown recount after that. So maybe several days until there's a final winner. But it looks as if Bevin eked it out. And if folks haven't been paying close attention, Bevin is a businessman, never won an election before. There was a third guy named Hal Heiner, who was a city councilor, but also is a wealthy businessman. And you have Comer, so the more traditional Politico, won elective office, statewide in the past. And Comer got accused of domestic abuse when he was in college, about 3 weeks before the election. And a blogger had been peddling the charges for months before the woman herself actually came forward a few weeks ago. In Kentucky, when you run for governor, you run with a running mate in the primary. So the lieutenant governor candidate with Heiner, her husband apparently had been working with the blogger, leading the James Comer campaign to blame Heiner for the charges and claim that it was all a setup. Heiner for a long time said I had nothing to do with this, but at the very, very end he actually runs an ad where he doesn't quite level the charges but certainly raises the charges in an ad, making a bit more complicit in the accusation. The woman at hand has been speaking publicly, and in sort of an odd side note, she used to live with Lowell Weicker, the former governor of Connecticut, not in a romantic way, in a platonic way, as far as I can tell. And Comer was saying how there was like some book of Weicker's that she got signed by Weicker and sent it to him, and that proves that they were on good terms. And she was saying that doesn't mean that. So that's a weird little side story. And Bevin did the classic above the fray. Comer and Heiner are in this ridiculous food fight. He had an ad where they're literally wearing suits and throwing, kids' food at each other. We need someone who's not going to play cheap politics, that's going to stand up for conservative values. And to me, that seemed to be the argument that won the day. Although I had a back and forth with a guy on Twitter last night who was saying, no. It's because everyone in the Tea Party hates McConnell, and they're mad how McConnell's been set a majority leader, and so they stuck with Bevin. And to the extent that that's true, it's because Bevin got 33% of the vote last night and got 35% of the vote versus McConnell a year ago. So he held on to his anti-McConnell vote, and the McConnell folks split between Comer and Heiner, as far as I can tell.
That's a
So
that sounds
you have this
plausible.
fracture with Kentucky Party there, and to the extent that it matters, if Bevin is just holding on to the far right, does that give Jack Conway, the Democratic nominee, who you might recall the leveler of the Aqua Buddha charge against Rand Paul, now making a comeback, does he have a chance to win the governorship? And this is a state where they already have a Democratic governor. Can he come back because Bevin's not a good statewide candidate in a general election?
I mean, I guess this happened before, as you implied, and Rand Paul was able to win against the same Democratic candidate. Rand Paul, like Bevin, had some things that could prove embarrassing. In the case of Rand Paul, Mitch McConnell essentially buddied up to him, and they made peace, and McConnell had an incentive to do that. He wanted to be the majority leader, so having an extra Republican elected that year would help, and perhaps wanted to co-opt Rand Paul. I don't know that McConnell has the same incentive to help Bevin. So first of all, even though Rand Paul beat Mitch McConnell's hand-picked candidate, he didn't challenge Mitch McConnell directly, whereas Matt Bevin did. I suspect that McConnell will publicly support. The other thing is obviously is that Mitch McConnell is now the majority leader, and Matt Bevin being governor of Kentucky doesn't help him or hurt him in his quest to be the master of the Senate. So my guess, without knowing anything personal here, my guess is McConnell will publicly embrace Bevin and will privately do nothing to help Bevin. And I would then surmise that Bevin does have a problem, that Conway has at least a 50-50 shot at this thing in a state that tends to lean Republican. It's not a bright red state, but it tends to go Republican. I would
Well, there seems to
say.
be a big division between how Kentucky votes in federal elections and how they vote in state elections. And I'm not on the ground there. I don't claim to have a real sense of the Kentucky psyche. But I mean, I found it strange actually looking at the Kentucky ads in this governor's race that all the Republicans were running against Obama. I'm going to fight Obama and his war on coal, as if they're running for Senate. There wasn't a whole lot of talk about Kentucky issues as far state issues that don't have federal implications, at least as I could tell in the ads. I mean, the debates might have been a different story. And they have a Democrat governor now who has been a proud implementer of Obamacare, though they obviously give it a Kentucky name. They call it I think it's Kentucky Connect. And that has proven pretty popular. But Bevin is saying he would scrap it. So does that cut Bevin's way? Can Bevin say, I'm going to repeal Obamacare? Or can Conway say, I'm going to keep Kentucky Connect? How that plays out, I can't say. But it does seem like you can't easily predict it because of the way the governor's races have gone, have diverged from the way presidential and state and senator elections have gone.
I think that there's a different calculus. Like in North Dakota, for example, until recently, they had three Democrats representing them statewide, two in the Senate, one in the House. And yet Republicans dominated everything from the state Senate to the state House to the governor to the lieutenant governor to the attorney general, insurance commissioner, ag commissioner, and you name it. So Republicans were dominating all of the state offices and state legislature, and Democrats until very recently were dominating the federal positions because North Dakota likes getting pork. That is, that's not necessarily the case anymore. It's changed. The now Hoeven, the former governor, ran for the Senate, and that sort of began the changing there. So yeah, I think it's different. I think voters look at electing a governor is different than electing a senator, and that may help or hurt Bevin, depending. But I think it could be a real race, and I would be surprised if McConnell really goes out of his way to really help Bevin. I think it'll be mostly perfunctory, unless I'm missing something.
Before we wrap things up, I'm gonna ambush you with a question that you're not prepared for.
All right, I'm gonna ambush you with a question then too. But you go first.
Why don't you want me to go first?
All right, I'll go first. Alan Grayson.
Go, you go first.
Alan Grayson, what's up with Alan Grayson, and what's your take on his chances?
I think Alan Grayson is crazy, and I would highly doubt he would get very far in a Florida primary. For folks who don't know, Grayson is back in the House. He had lost one race, but he got back in a safer district. He is talking about running for Senate. There is a Democrat running named Patrick Murphy, who is considered more of a moderate Democrat. And Grayson wants to challenge him from the left. And I think the DSCC, the Democratic Central Campaign Committee, has already put their money on Murphy. But Grayson is independently wealthy and could fund his own campaign. And we are seeing elements of a increased willingness in some areas, liberal Democrats, progressive populist Democrats, willing to challenge more moderate choices. But Grayson is in the middle of a very bitter divorce battle.
Gold digger's gonna gold dig, my friend.
Right. I mean, and when you make comments like that, those don't sound very economically populist. I have a lot, or very gender friendly. Here he is trying to demean his former wife. And calling her materialistic instead of trying to resolve his divorce in a more genteel way. That kind of behavior is not really the great way to start a senatorial campaign. And there's even some speculation that his girlfriend, his now girlfriend, wants to run for his House seat. And that might rankle people as well and lead to people questioning their stability. So I don't really see this as something that's going to get very far, even if he can self-fund. I think there are liberals who are very enamored with Grayson. They like the fact that he's pugnacious. They like the fact that he is willing to sort of call Republicans out, like with the classic, here's the Republican healthcare plan, don't get sick, die quickly. There are folks on the left that love that sort of thing. But I think there are limits to how much of those sorts of antics will be accepted, particularly in a big state like Florida, a diverse state. I don't think that kind of behavior is gonna get him very far.
All right, so I've got multiple choice questions. You can answer either one of these. Game of Thrones, do you watch it? What do you think about this latest controversy? And or Letterman is about to sign off.
You stole my ambush question.
Okay, then go ahead and ask that.
I was going to ask you how you felt about Letterman signing off. Did you grow up on Letterman? Did you have a sense of growing up with him? And did you embrace his style of comedy, or were you more of a Jay Leno guy? Did you like the more middle American sensibility of a Jay Leno, and Letterman was too sarcastic in New York for your conservative taste? I was going to get into all of that.
Great minds think alike. Okay, so for me, this may be betraying my age. I probably am a Carson guy. I think Johnny was.
You're too young to be a Carson guy. That's betraying that you're an old man, a young person's body.
Johnny's the king of late night comedy. I come down on the Letterman side. I'm edgier, more contrarian. More of a Letterman fan than a Leno fan. I went through a big Letterman stage. There was a time, when in the summers, when I was like in middle school and high school, when I would literally stay up all night and sleep most of the day. And it just got progressively worse every night. I would stay up later and later until eventually I was like going to bed when the sun came up. And got into Letterman when he was doing late night after Carson on NBC. Then sort of went away from it for a while. And when Dave moved to the Late Show, got into it again. And I remember The Turban Is Not For Sale was a big thing he used to do. The Turban Is Not For Sale. And this is when I was watching, and he had this thing where he was giving away canned hams. Like that was a big shtick for a while. That's sort of the eras. But we're talking 15 or 20 years since I was a dedicated Dave fan. And from what I've heard, it's kind of time for him to hang it up. But yeah, I come down on Team Dave and the versus Letterman battle. How about you?
Well, again, great minds do think alike. Actually, I haven't watched them in a while, but so there was a time where like, that was what you did. You went to bed with Letterman, and I just think he. We often praise people and laud them with historical type accolades when probably it's not quite justified, but. I feel in the case of Letterman, I think the trajectory of comedy did change with him. That it became more, it became edgier, it became more acerbic and sarcastic, it became a little less safe. It tested the boundaries of what would be embraced by broader swaths of the country. I mean, yes, Leno had an edge, and Letterman wasn't everybody's taste, but it wasn't like Letterman was strictly a New York City phenomena. He had a Midwestern sensibility too in his
Yeah.
way.
I heard an interview on Terry Gross about a year or two ago on Fresh Air. She replayed an interview she did with Letterman from like the late 70s, early 80s. And two things really struck me. One, this is before he had his own show, I think. So he was like a known comedian, but not, I guess it was right before he got late night, maybe. I'm not sure when exactly that happened, but either way, he wasn't a big name, as big of a name at the time. And two things struck me. Like one, he saw the trends. He said the next wave is going to be stand-up comedians getting sitcoms. And he was basically like, I expect Bill Cosby will have a sitcom and will become a big star, and that'll open the door for other people to do it. And of course that happened. The other thing that was interesting is back then, this is in like the late 70s, early 80s, she asked him, Terry Gross asked him, like, who are the best comedians out there? Who are your favorite comedians? And he named Jay Leno as like the best young comedian to keep an eye on, which I thought was very
Right. I mean,
interesting.
Leno used to be a guest on his show. I think it's one of the reasons why that rivalry got so bitter, because Letterman sort of felt like he brought Leno up. But there's one element where I feel like Letterman is kind of, last of the line and not someone that leaves a stamp on. I mean, I think leaves a stamp on comedy as far as his comedic sensibility is concerned. Where I think he what will be lost with him is the notion of good conversation as a television draw. And he wasn't the inventor of that, and neither was Carson. I mean, you had people like Dick Cavett and Jack Parr before them. I think the notion of sort of, I mean, even in non-comedic things like William Buckley, like Firing Line is a conversational show, and we don't have conversational Sunday morning political talk anymore. It's all very soundbitey. It's all looking to get clips that can be shared on YouTube. You don't have as much long form.
You go. I think you go to. I think you go to Mark Maron and Terry Gross and podcasts probably for that.
Right, I mean, it exists as sort of a niche market now, and not kind of the main event on broadcast TV. You know, maybe Charlie Rose would be be one of the last examples of that. But again, I imagine that audience is skewing pretty old these days, and that's not in the realm of comedy. Carson was more of a sort of an easygoing conversationalist, and Letterman was kind of the master of socially awkward conversationalists. So he sort of put his own twist on it. But there still was sort of a premium, sort of let's get people on who I can have a good conversation with and not just do bits all the time. And, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel have sort of mastered the art of sort of getting celebrities to do little stunts that are YouTube friendly. Mm-hmm. That's different than being having kind of a rich conversation that might draw out some insights they don't necessarily get from a staged bit. And I imagine that's probably gonna be lost now to history.
Yes, although I suspect these things are cyclical. Somebody, the right person, will come around and it'll be back. But yeah, you're right. It's a changing of the guard, and another sign that things are changing. And I will bitterly cling to the past as a conservative. But I'm a bitter clinger. I will cling to my God and guns and Letterman. But the world moves on. I'm a Johnny Carson guy living in a Jimmy Kimmel world, I suppose.
But I'm curious to see what Stephen Colbert does with The Slot. I'm curious to see what Samantha Bee does on TBS. I think that's going to be an interesting project. And I like what John Oliver has done HBO.
And Colbert.
As far as sort of souping up.
Colbert, obviously, yeah. So, yeah, it's the times they are a-changing. But here we still are producing great blogging heads TV content, the DMZ.
Conversational. The last of the conversationalist, you and me.
Outlasting Letterman, outlasting the quitters. So check us out. Well, last week we plugged me a lot, Bill. And I don't like to talk about myself. I don't like to self-promote. You know that. So why don't you self-promote?
All I got this week is the Real Clear Politics piece that I did on Monday. So check that out if you haven't read that yet. My helpful advice to Republican Party. And we'll see if I can get something else worth plugging for next week.
All right, let's do it. And you can tell a friend about this show, for crying out loud. You know, spread the good news about the DMZ. There's a place where people can have civil conversation about politics and disagree and have fun. Tell a friend, hug a cop, visit us on Twitter at DMZ Show, same thing on Facebook, and post your comments. We like them. We sometimes respond. So please keep doing it. And anything else, Bill?
And we'll do this again next week.
All right. See you guys.
Take care.